The Art of Disobedience for Writers and Other Artists.
The best art is always disobedient. The creative works that move us and compel us, that provoke us, haunt us, and I think even transform us, you know, the works that matter to us and that we cherish break the rules in some sort of significant way.
That's writing teacher K.L. Cook. We spend the hour with him talking about the art and craft of writing and his collection of essays about that, The Art of Disobedience. That's today's entree on the menu for Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rihanna. K.L. Cook has been teaching writing for a long time. An award-winning writer himself, he's professor of English and co-coordinator of the MFA program in creative writing and environment at Iowa State University. He's also a longtime faculty member of the Low Residency MFA program in writing at Spalding University. Cook has distilled some of the most important lessons he's learned about the art of writing fiction in his new book, The Art of Disobedience, Essays on Form, Fiction, and Influence. In the book's essays, he explores issues of aesthetics, craft, form, process, influence, and what it means to spend a life in letters. Among those explorations is why secrets are at the heart of every story, why point of view is perhaps the most important decision a fiction writer can make, and why disobedience to the rules is the critical secret sauce to great writing. K.L. Cook is the author of 6 books of fiction, poetry, and essays, including Last Call, The Girl from Charnel, and Love Songs for the Quarantined. In addition to The Art of Disobedience, he's out with 2 other recent books, Marrying Kind, a collection of short stories, and a collection of poetry, Lost Soliloquies. K.L. Cook, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So it's been a long time since we've interviewed a writer about the craft of writing, actually. And your book, The Art of Disobedience, 20 Ways to Misbehave, is a book about the craft of writing, and it was really a delight to read. You start the book out by saying one should take an inventory of the kind of writer that one actually is. What do you mean by that, the kind of writer that one is?
Well, several things. I mean, what is your temperament as a writer, and really, what is your approach to work as much as anything else? Are you a more methodical kind of writer? Isaac Dennison, a.k.a. Karen Blixen, who wrote Out of Africa, famously said that she likes to write a little bit every day without hope or despair. And I think there are a lot of writers who engage in that writing process in that more methodical way, and they try to take some of the emotion out of it, try to accomplish a little bit every day. There are other writers who operate by crisis management and damage control. they're waiting for the muse to hit them, or they need deadlines, either self-imposed or external deadlines, to create a kind of panic and a kind of adrenaline that brings out their best work, or so they think. And I used to not worry about these kinds of process issues when I was first teaching writers, both freshman composition writers as well as creative writers. But the longer I have done this, the more I have felt that it is the most important thing to address. Certainly craft is crucial in influence, and we can talk about some of that shortly, I'm assuming. But trying to figure out what kind of writer you are, doing an inventory of your strategies, either conscious or unconscious, for putting together a manuscript, or composing and revising and editing a manuscript, is a sort of a crucial process, I think, for you as a writer.
And what kind of writer are you?
Well, I aspire to be Isaac Dennison-like, you know, to write a little bit every day without hope or despair. Unfortunately, I'm not that person. I have a complex life. I'm a professor. I'm a part-time administrator. I'm a director of an MFA program. I have four children, and I also am juggling a lot of different writing projects. So I tend to sort of run around doing a little damage control and crisis management myself. But the nice thing about being in academia is that we get longer breaks that allow you to regroup, decompress, and hopefully make more significant progress on longer projects. So I've depended a great deal on the summers, and during the summers, I usually put myself on a more disciplined regimen.
So you said the word influence. What would you like to tell us about influence?
Well, I think in literary circles, influence has had a bad rap for a while. And it's partially because of Harold Bloom, perhaps the most famous literary critic in America, if not the world, who wrote a book a long time ago called The Anxiety of Influence, in which he suggested that every writer is working out in a particular text influences, either conscious or unconscious, and that the page is a kind of battleground. But what I have come to embrace, both for myself as well as for my students, is the notion of the ecstasy of influence. This is a phrase that Jonathan Lethem, the novelist and essayist, coined and wrote a wonderful essay in The Atlantic that you can Google and find easily. But it's also the title essay for a book on the ecstasy of influence, in which he said that writers should embrace their influences, that we can't get around, like any artist, we don't operate in a vacuum, that we're always in conversation with the traditions that come before us, with the writers that have meant a great deal to us. And it's rather than to run away from that or to feel anxious about that relationship, we should embrace it. We should examine it and explore it and make it part of our own work. That's how new literature is made, not out of a desire to create something original, but to be in conversation with what's come before. And the originality comes from that conversation.
Yeah, that puts me in mind of one of my favorite interviews about the craft of writing, which was a long time ago. It was with Francine Prose about her book, Reading Like a Writer, where you really do get that sense of the ecstasy of influence, the real appreciation of how you have to really read to be a writer.
Absolutely. And I love Francine's book. And all writers that I know of were first and foremost passionate readers, and that the impulse to write really came out of a desire to join the conversation, to maybe create something that will help others in the way that writers have helped you. So this is a natural conversation, and it's odd that in writing especially, there's this kind of false narrative about the anxiety of influence.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with writer and teacher of writing, K.L. Cook, about his book of essays on the craft of writing, The Art of Disobedience. So this book, The Art of Disobedience, is really about writing fiction. And I guess I'd like to ask you, first of all, why do you just focus on fiction because that's what you teach? And maybe you could talk a little bit about fiction and creative nonfiction and the ways in which they're the same or different.
I am primarily a fiction writer. I've published four books of fiction, three collections of stories and a novel, and as well as a collection of poetry and then this book of essays, plus a lot of other essays. And I'm working on some nonfiction projects. I also come out of a theater background, and my wife is a playwright and playwriting professor and scriptwriter, and I love film. So I definitely embrace all the genres, and I'm fortunate to teach in and co-direct a program that embraces this sort of multi-genre approach. The Art of Disobedience is primarily about fiction. The subtitle is Essays on Form, Fiction, and Influence. In part because that's what I've spent the majority of my life, my teaching life, is talking about the craft and art of fiction, helping my undergraduate and graduate students and colleagues with their own stories and novels and novellas. But I've also worked extensively with nonfiction writers and people in other genres. And the book does reference and is applicable, I think, to the other genres. In fact, some of the more significant essays in the book deal with other genres. For instance, My Hamlet is about my 35-year haunted complex relationship with that play and with Shakespeare. And narrative design and a narrative strategy and dramatic design uses Othello as a sort of primary text, even though I'm referring to a wide range of novels and other pieces of fiction, but also television and other scripts. So anyway, I come to it as a fiction writer, but also a fiction writer who loves to work in other genres and believes in the sort of cross-pollination and energy of working in other genres. The relationship between fiction and nonfiction, to me, they're creative nonfiction is this kind of odd term, or literary nonfiction, that people outside of academia or outside of sort of literary circles, I think, feel some ambivalence about. But essentially what we're talking about is non-journalistic or information-based work, that creative nonfiction or literary nonfiction is work that aspires to the condition of literature, that, one of the best things you can say about a work of creative nonfiction is that it reads like a novel, for instance, or it has the density and complexity of a piece of fiction. And certainly when I teach creative nonfiction, narrative creative nonfiction, I am encouraging that, that kind of approach. But nonfiction isn't always narrative or even always character-driven, as fiction is or drama is. And you can do other things in a nonfiction, in a work of nonfiction, even literary nonfiction, including having essays or going on non-narrative, a story or story-driven riffs, which is one of the great pleasures of writing a nonfiction for me, and one of the great pleasures of writing this book too. That even though many of the essays are addressed to and are meant to be beneficial for fellow writers, several of them are memoir-esque and tell my more personal story in my relationship to these texts.
Yeah, because, I think of some of my favorite influences. W.G. Zabold is one of them, and so much of his work, you forget that you're reading fiction, and you even wonder sometimes if you are reading fiction, because they seem so memoir-based. Have you read Zabold?
No, I haven't read much of Zabold.
Yeah, because, I think of some of my favorite influences. W.G. Zabold is one of them, and so much of his work, you forget that you're reading fiction, and you even wonder sometimes if you are reading fiction, because they seem so memoir-based. But I actually want to go back to your title, The Art of Disobedience. And I think I should have started there. Why disobedience?
Well, I think that the best art is always disobedient. And it doesn't matter whether it's fiction or plays or visual arts or a film. The creative works that move us and compel us, that provoke us, haunt us, and I think even transform us, the works that matter to us and that we cherish break the rules in some sort of significant way. And, characters act up, they act out, they transgress, they misbehave. But my argument is that the writer must also surprise or subvert, deconstruct, and engage in serious mischief in terms of genre or form or sensibility, tone, in order to make the familiar strange and the strange familiar, which is one of the primary things we're looking for. And even though I have a specific essay that has 20 different strategies for fiction writers to effectively misbehave, either with the characters or more aesthetically or in terms of the approach to the subject matter, the general argument I make applies to all the arts, that this is what fascinates us as readers, as audience members. This is why we're drawn to art, is because we see characters getting into trouble. We see people getting into trouble, are going to places that that maybe aren't supposed to go, at least in polite civil society. And the very act of doing that allows them to get into productive trouble. Productive in the sense that it's revelatory, you know, that it leads to a crisis that helps us ruminate on, to think about, to experience with the characters what it means to transgress in some sort of way, and what the consequences of that transgression are. It's a moral as well as emotional and intellectual and creative exercise that is part of what we're attracted to.
A moral exercise.
Yeah. Disobedience is, you know, I'm invoking a moral, you know, the moral world there, the ethical world. And fiction, especially, but I think all the arts exist in a gray zone. Or, you know, I think the best works of art are always examining the boundaries of morality and amorality. And they help us negotiate those boundaries with greater nuance and subtlety.
Yeah, in fact, you say that the purpose of literature is to promote compassion and empathy.
Yeah, and I do think that that is at the heart of what we're trying to do here. The very act of writing a piece of fiction is to examine the inner life. And I know that for myself, one of the distinctions between fiction and nonfiction, writing memoir or writing a memoir, an essay, or writing a short story, to come back to your earlier question about the difference between the two genres, is in fiction, I am much more willing to enter into the consciousness of characters who are unlike me. And there is the very act, the imaginative act of trying to walk in someone else's shoes is an act of compassion, of empathy. And, imaginative fellow feeling. You're trying to understand that person's world. And that's what's so thrilling to me about writing fiction. One of the things that I always feel liberated when I'm doing that, as opposed to writing memoir or nonfiction where I'm attached to the facts.
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, I wonder, is it something that you can really teach, or does it have to be innate? Because I know for myself, I just don't feel like I can write fiction, that I can, in fact, invent characters. I can take characters that I know something about and imagine something more about them, but I don't think I can make them up out of whole cloth. And I've often just thought, well, you know, that's just the way I am. Or is it something you can actually learn?
That's a great question. And it's, of course, a question that is that has always nagged at creative writing teachers. Can it be taught? Can it not be taught? I obviously have spent most of my life teaching it, so I believe it can be taught. Otherwise, I would, in a very cynical situation, you know, where I hate my job or don't really believe in its value. So, yeah, I do believe it can be taught, or that there are strategies that will help you navigate in that world. But the very thing that you just described actually is a way into fiction, that you, rather than thinking about fiction as being something that is invented from a whole, that it's completely new. For some writers, that is where they start, and that fiction must be this totally imaginative, inventing act of creation. But there are just as many fiction writers who start from what they know, and then they write about what they don't know about what they know. So what you just described is an example of that. Like, I can imagine, you said, I can imagine writing about someone's life that I know well and try to understand their perspective. And that would involve an act of imagination. My own work often begins this way. I started writing fiction, became a writer, really, in large part to tell the stories of my family. I come from a working class family. I was the first member of my family to go to college. They were railroad workers, and and restaurant owners and con men and, you know, bartenders, you know, the kind of a renegade group. My father was a bit of a con man who tried to buy Costa Rica, and he died when I was in my early 20s, and I was studying theater and literature at the time. And that was that was a turning point for me. After his death, I thought, okay, if I don't commit to telling his story or the stories of my other family members, then they're going to be lost to oblivion. And I didn't want to lose them, nor to have their stories lost. So a lot of my early work, but still today has been about imagining what my mother's life might have been like, for instance, when she was 16 and living in a small panhandle Texas town. Her parents had divorced. She was essentially left alone as the only girl in the family to take care of everyone. You know, I tried to imagine that world, and that became my first novel, The Girl from Charnel. Last Call is my first book, a collection of linked stories about the same family of characters, and it covers about 32 years in the life of this fictional family that's similar to mine, but I take some liberties. But really, it was driven by this desire to try to understand my uncles and my aunts and my grandparents and my father's experience, and as well as my mother's experience, and to try to imagine their life and resurrect them in a way.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with K.L. Cook about his book of essays on the craft of writing, The Art of Disobedience. You know, it's so interesting what you say, because you write in this book, K.L. Cook, you write in The Art of Disobedience, that a story without secrets is not a story, that every plot at its core is a ritual of revelation. And you've just referred to your family, and you've also co-taught a course on literature and psychology that was about family systems, which was very interesting to me because it's what I studied as a social when I got my social work degree. Was family systems. And you're right, secrets are really at the core of families, but part of the secret is to keep the secret. I mean, that's what drives so many families, you know, that do have secrets at their core. And here you're talking about revealing those secrets. So was that a struggle for you?
It was a struggle for me at first. And one of the reasons that I think I gravitated towards fiction as opposed to nonfiction, especially early in my career, was that fiction allowed me a mask that I could always say, this is, you know, I made this up. This is a piece of fiction. Or if it's rooted in my family's life, it is, I've taken liberties, and you should not make a one-to-one equation between this character and my mother, or this character and my father. So partly I started writing fiction in order to be liberated from that sort of strain that you're talking about. But one of the fascinating things about co-teaching this course with a family systems theorist and therapist, he was also my dean at the time, and my best friend, Wayne Regina, is his name. We taught it off and on for about 20 years. You know, one of the revelatory comments that he would routinely make in class is that there are no secrets in families, that they're known, whether unconsciously or consciously, they're felt, and that often the anxiety within a family system surrounds the suppression of that secret or the revelation of that secret, and those two forces sort of being in opposition. And then that resonated deeply with me, and in many ways helped me finish some of my early books, some of that discussion, some of the excavation of the theory about family systems and its relationship to film and literature. The course was called Family Systems in Film and Literature, and it was pitched towards advanced psychology students as well as creative writing and literature students. One of the things I began to toy with and think about a while ago, though, is is that literature really depends upon this, that that in fact, all stories are really rituals of revelation. They are all secrecy plots, and that there are essentially four stages of every plot, that there is an existing secret that is trying to be either that needs to be uncovered or investigated. And oftentimes we have investigators in any sort of mystery plot, or we are following the character who is trying to keep the secret, and secret keepers. And sometimes, especially in genre fiction, we have macro secrets, such as in a sci-fi or fantasy world where the author has created a world in which there is a macro secret that we're sort of waiting with bated breath until the end to discover. A couple of sort of corny examples are Planet of the Apes, where at the very end of the first Planet of the Apes, Charlton Heston, comes upon the head of the Statue of Liberty and realizes that the Planet of the Apes is really Earth. Or Soylent Green, another Charlton Heston favorite from the 60s, where he realizes the people are Soylent Green. So that's kind of a macro secret, and I'm not as excited about those kinds of plots. But to come back to the sort of ritual of revelation, there is always the sort of secret that needs investigating or that needs to be kept, and that the plot always moves towards a revelation. It needs to move towards a revelation so that there can be a reckoning, so that there are consequences for the exposure of the secret. And those can be moral, and they can be psychological, physical, legal, emotional, certainly. And then a recalibration is the sort of final phase. Like, how are characters, how are host systems, family systems, other kinds of systems reshaped, recalibrated as a result of the revelation and reckoning that occurs. So that was a fascinating insight. And then I did a lot of sort of deep diving into my own reading, into my own experience, into all the manuscripts that I was reading, especially Shakespeare, and realized, oh my goodness, this holds up. And it's a different way of conceiving plot that is much more connected to characters and to our patterns of behavior. Why do we go to fiction? Why do we go to narrative? Well, we go to see, to see this sort of ritual enacted.
And yet the title of your book is The Art of Disobedience, in which you say the purpose of the writer is to break some rules. This seems to be like a rule, but maybe it's not a rule. Maybe it's, I think of DNA of life, right? There's the DNA are certain rules that are laid down, and we can't really disobey them without, risking our lives, right? That's where bad genes go. So tease out for us a little bit more than, kind of what's the difference between a DNA of a story and a rule of a story that you'd like to, that would be a good thing to disobey.
Well, I love the way that you've conceptualized that as the DNA, and I think my theory about secrecy plots, that all narratives are really essentially rituals of revelation or secrecy plots. I hadn't framed it as the DNA of story, but I'm now going to steal that. Thank you, Francesca, because I do think that that's what I'm suggesting, rather than as a rule. Like, this is how it works. Sometimes a writer will scramble the order. Sometimes the writer will focus, primarily on one part of that plot as opposed to another. But that is sort of the condition of narratives, that in order for them to go somewhere, we have to see characters sort of maintaining secrets, or there has to be a sort of plot in which something has to be investigated. We start with a crime scene, for instance, and we follow the investigator as he or she tries to find the killer or tries to uncover the clues that will lead to the revelation of the perpetrator. In terms of disobedience, what I'm suggesting is that is a strategy that is part of this DNA. That if, for instance, we are tracking a character, the protagonist is someone who is keeping a secret, such as Macbeth or Hamlet or Iago, that we are asked to be with that character, and part of us knows that the character is in danger of having the secret revealed. And we want the secret revealed. We want them to get caught, but we also don't want them to get caught. To do more contemporary examples, think of Breaking Bad or Mad Men or The Americans or, you know, any sort of good television right now. We're often asked to identify with the characters who are keeping secrets, often criminal secrets. And we are asked to enter into their experience and feel doubly drawn. Like morally, we know that they need to be caught. They're engaging in bad things, and it's leading to bad consequences for them and their families and others. And yet part of us wants them to get away with it. And that's part of what I mean by disobedience. Like we enter into that experience, and the writer, by the very choice of a protagonist who is caught in this way, who is implicated in this way, is electrifying. And it's part of what keeps us moving through multiple episodes and multiple seasons of a show or through a long book. Or we are following an investigator, Hercule Poirot or any other Agatha Christie protagonist or a CSI investigator on television. We are drawn into the compulsion to track down someone who has misbehaved, who has committed a kind of disobedience. And to what lengths will we go to, or will the investigator go to find that that killer or that perpetrator? Or within a family, to what lengths will a family member go to reveal a secret about the family, to open it up, to expose it? What risk will that person take emotionally or legally or intellectually?
K.L. Cook. We'll be back to talk with him more about The Art of Disobedience, essays on form, fiction, and influence. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. We're talking today with writer and teacher of writing, K.L. Cook, about his new book, The Art of Disobedience. Just before the break, we were talking about why it's so important for writers to have the courage to break the rules. Yet rules are also useful and necessary, even though it's also necessary to know when and how to break them. One key area that governs the rule choices writers make is point of view. Let's rejoin K.L. Cook to talk about that. So let's turn now to point of view, which you say is the most important decision you make as a fiction writer. First of all, why is it the most important decision you make? And then tell us about, you know, starting with first person. Tell us a little bit about the, you know, how to make that choice as to person.
Well, thank you for asking about point of view, because I do think it's one of the most misunderstood aspects of craft. And yet it is, as I argue, the most important technical element and narrative strategy that as a fiction writer you need to understand. And I make this case in large part because fiction is its primary value and pleasure is taking us into the inner life of characters. Right? When we watch a television show or we watch a movie, we only have the visuals and we have their dialogue and we have action. And the character is revealed through his or her action and what is said, and maybe by contrast and counterpoint. But in fiction, we expect to do a deep dive into the psychology of characters. We get to go where normally we don't get to go. We get to go inside the consciousness of a character in action. And the primary tool that a fiction writer has to enter into that interior life is its point of view. And different point of view techniques will create different effects. So, for instance, and there's essentially two different general forms of techniques, first person or third person. And, you know, as a fiction writer, you start with I, you start with she, and that will have a slightly different effect. If I say, I went to the store today and saw my former girlfriend, and it saddened me, especially after we had this conversation, but then we got together, I'm starting to tell a confessional in a way, and it feels more immediate. You're on my side. But if I say, he or James went to the store today and ran into Francesca and suddenly remembered their torrid affair from 20 years ago. And he was uncertain of whether she would recognize him, but she did. And then they had coffee. Suddenly there's some distance there, and there's maybe even a bit of comic distance, but it's a different kind of story that is going on. And we feel differently about it, in part because we're using first person or third person. You could bring in second person too. If I said, you went to the store today and you ran into your old boyfriend, Harold, and that could start to feel like I'm telling you about your experience, or the you as a substitute for I. I can take a deeper dive into first person or third person or second person if you wish. But part of what this general point I would make is that if you're a fiction writer, you better really study the different strategies for and techniques for telling your story. And point of view is the most important one. And I outline about 15 different versions of point of view, a first, third, and second person point of view techniques, so that writers can better understand the effects of that choice of technique and what it might mean in a later draft to completely change your point of view from first person to third person, as I did with my novel. I wrote it in third person, completely changed it to first person, and then changed it to an omniscient point of view, which is a sort of expansive third person, and then change it back to sort of a close third person, just from the perspective of the protagonist, the character that I said earlier was based largely on my mother. That process was important for me to go through, even though it was laborious, but it helped me understand more than anything else I've ever done the effects of different point of view techniques or strategies on the work itself.
Yeah, one point you make that really struck me was that first-person point of view is good for political purposes. I mean, if you're writing a book, let's say, about, you know, the kind of character who often is not given a voice in our culture, it's more effective to do so in the first person.
Yeah, and it's one of the arguments that I often make are ways of framing or contextualizing the discussion for my students or even myself. It's like, okay, who gets a voice in this narrative? And is there going to be a filter on that voice? So for instance, if I use third person, as I did in that example earlier, what you're hearing is me as the mediating or filtering agent, that you hear my presence as an author, as a go-between between me and the character. But when I use first person, and if I'm using it, even if I'm using it like a ventriloquist would or a chameleon, or an actor, I'm entering into another character's voice and letting him or her tell his or her own story, then I think that is an act of great generosity on the author's part. And you're essentially taking away the filter. You're letting that person speak for himself or herself. And that can be really crucial if you consider yourself a political writer.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with writer and teacher of writing, K.L. Cook, about his book of essays on the craft of writing, The Art of Disobedience. You know, you have a wonderful example. I mean, this is very much related to the idea of distance, psychic distance. And I'm just going to read it out loud here. The example of differing, of approximations, of different stages of proximity, let's say. number one, the most distance is it was the winter of 1853. A large man stepped out of a doorway. The second example is Henry J. Warburton had never much cared for snowstorms. The third example is Henry hated snowstorms. The fourth example, God, how he hated these damn snowstorms. And the fifth example was snow under your collar, down inside your shoes, freezing and plugging up your miserable soul. I just love that because you made it so crystal clear what could be something that it would be difficult to understand that is what is psychic distance. But right there, you don't even have to explain it. It's show, not tell.
Thank you for using that example. I should say that example comes from John Gardner, the great modern writer, and he wrote a great book called The Art of Fiction that was one of the first and most important sort of underground creative writing texts. And I still use it in my teaching now. He seems a little authoritarian now, and it puts some students off, but he really encourages people to aspire, to aim high with their work. But what I love about that example is, and I remember reading it for the first time many years ago, it brought home to me just how subtle and nuanced the tool of point of view is, and that you have to know how to use it. It's not just that the tool itself is well made. You have to understand and use it consistently in order to create a consistent effect. And his argument there is that if all of those different examples are used within the same paragraph, it's disorienting for the reader. And it's one of the ways that we sense the clumsiness of an amateur as opposed to the sort of effortless mastery of someone who's been doing this for a long time, is that they are consistent with what he calls the psychic distance or narrative distance, that we are positioned carefully where we need to be. And I think the other example he uses, and some other writers have used too, is like with a filmmaker, right? A great filmmaker knows when to do a close-up, when to do a medium shot, when to do a long shot, and how to negotiate those three distances. And the psychic distance is the equivalent for a fiction writer.
Now, to talk about the workshops, you know, I've never attended a writer's workshop, I must confess. And I think one of the reasons is because, although I have been in writing groups and they've been quite useful, so maybe that's just a little bit different. But one of the reasons is, you know, I just wasn't sure what it really meant or how helpful it could be. You talk about workshop, writing workshop, as a gift community. What is a gift community first? And then how do you structure your workshops to be one?
Thank you for asking that question. I think it's an important question. And I think you're not unlike most writers or most people who are somewhat familiar with the way creative writing is taught and conducted in the United States, at least, and mystified by it too. Well, what's the advantage of a bunch of fellow writers sitting around talking about the work, and isn't that dangerous? And doesn't it lead to a bunch of backbiting and you know pit of vipers? Well, it can, and part of the reason that I write this long essay about the workshop as a gift community is to offer a different model for how the workshop I think can and should be conducted, so that it is instructive for everyone. And not just the writer, so that it encourages people to want to go back to the work and make it stronger, but from not just to fix faults. The gift community really comes from Lewis Hyde, who he wrote this great book called The Gift. It's had many subtitles over the years. He wrote it about 30 years ago, and it has become at first a cult classic among writers and artists. But now it has sort of entered the mainstream. He's gone on to write some other great books, Trickster Makes the World and The Common, about the commons. And he won a MacArthur Genius Award essentially for The Gift. And he is a poet by training, but he had done this great examination of the artist's relationship to his or her gift and the way that a talent or a gift operates essentially in two realms. One, the realm of a commercial economy. You create something, hopefully you sell it, you make a living, you write some more, you work your way towards Steven Spielberg wealth or Toni Morrison Nobel Prize fame. And he's also studying the potlatch cultures and other kinds of cultures that operate in a gift community, that even though I may be able to sell my book, my novel, and it makes a lot of money, I also hope that it operates in a gift economy, a gift community, so that the reader reads it and finds it valuable and nurturing and nourishing on a level that goes beyond just a transactional monetary pleasure. It's a great book. It's a dense book, but it's a wonderful book. I often teach it. My students sometimes complain about it, in part because it can't be read like a novel. It's a denser piece of meditative work, but it is the work that is more fully influenced me as a teacher as well as a writer than any other book. And I'm not the only one. The list of writers who have been profoundly affected by this book is extensive. It includes Margaret Atwood and Jonathan Lethem and David Wallace Foster, you name it. And it extends beyond literature. So what I've tried to do over three dozen years of teaching creative writing is essentially create a gift community in my classroom, that our goal here is to nurture one another, and that we go about doing this by learning a system for responding to one another's work that is valuable for everyone. The writer, the individual member of the workshop who in a solitary way is trying to examine the work, and then the whole group as we come together and try to make sense of that work. And the way I go about it in terms of process is to essentially have a describe, praise, and question model of workshop, that rather than leaping in and talking as we often do after, you're with friends and you go see a movie or something, or you read a book, or you're in a book club and you sort of leap to the things that aren't working or that you love, you start with description. Our primary job is to reflect back like a good therapist or a good mirror, the work as we experienced it. That is the most valuable thing for the writer, but it is the most valuable thing for us as a group, as an aesthetic community to do, to try to tease out and unpack and make sense of the poem or story or novel or memoir before us. And then we try to engage beyond that descriptive work and analytical work in praise. Like, what is authentically compelling, moving, distinctive, funny about this piece? Sometimes writers don't know what is the best part of the work, and sometimes we feel differently about what is good or compelling or distinctive about a work. And that discussion is useful for everyone, but it also, by starting with description and with appreciation or praise, the writer feels understood, hopefully feels understood, or at least understands how he or she has been misread or the shortcomings in the own work. I think it's the most valuable thing we do. And then you start critique, not with like, I didn't like this or this really bugged me, but with a sense of inquiry and interrogation, like asking questions, raising issues about the work in a more inquiring sort of way to help the writer understand, to help us all understand how the work is at, maybe at cross purposes with itself or where it seems to be derailed. Because the writer has had the advantage of hearing how everyone has attempted to understand the work, they will also better understand how to accept the feedback or the questions that are being asked that will lead them to revision and hopefully a deeper exploration of the work.
Well, that's really wonderful. There's so much more in this wonderful book, The Art of Disobedience. But before we end, I just want to touch on another topic, a very timely one, and that's about another one of your books, a collection of stories about quarantine. You wrote it before COVID-19, but I'd like to ask you, first of all, we're in a time of quarantine now, and I wonder if it's giving you a different perspective on the stories that you wrote about quarantine. Maybe just situate us, tell us a little bit about that book. But mostly I'm interested in how reality might be changing the way you are looking at your earlier work.
That is a great question. My third book was called Love Songs for the Quarantine, and it was a collection of thematically linked stories, although there were some recurring characters. And the title story, Love Song for the Quarantine, is about a family that is quarantined by the local health department because of, I forget, it's sort of a common illness that I can't, it's not coming to me right now, which is a shame. It'll probably come to me during this conversation. And about what, how they deal with that, that level of quarantine. But the whole book, as I talk about in one of the essays in The Art of Disobedience, is about different kinds of quarantine, physical quarantine, but also emotional and psychological quarantine and moral quarantine. And I've been thinking a lot about the way that that previous work of mine now will read for people, because we're all experiencing worldwide this strange sense of isolation. We're learning all sorts of new strategies for connection. We're but also engaging with a real sense of mourning or loss, grief about what the world looks like now. What we, even when we watch, you know, television shows and we're seeing people in restaurants or we're seeing people kiss or in an office, suddenly, I don't know if you're experiencing this, but my wife and I and my kids are experiencing this sort of strange double vision where we go, yeah, I recognize that world. And oh my gosh, why don't they have masks on? Why are they 6 feet apart? So there's this kind of weird double vision that we all have. The world we're experiencing now that feels dangerous and just, you know, the most innocuous social interactions feel insidious and scary. And that's painful. It hurts.
Yeah, it does. And I want to thank you, K.L. Cook, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about your book, The Art of Disobedience. This book is not only important, I mean, I found it useful in light of my own writing, even though I don't write fiction, but I do write creative nonfiction, which I think, you know, much of this is very useful too, but also as a reader, it gave me a greater sense of how to construct or think about the reading that I do. So valuable for all of us. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Francesca, and I really appreciate you saying that.
K.L. Cook is the author of 6 books of fiction, poetry, and essays. He is professor of English and co-coordinator of the MFA program in creative writing and environment at Iowa State University, and also teaches at the low residency MFA program in writing at Spalding University. We have just enough time for a poem about quarantine. Last week, I wrote on Twitter that if I have to read or hear the words again in these uncertain times, I was going to have a meltdown. But that was before I came across a poem by Jessica Salfia, which expressed perfectly how I feel about the new coronavirus quarantine cliches. It's called The First Lines of Emails I've Received While Quarantining. In these uncertain times, as we navigate the new normal, are you willing to share your ideas and solutions? As you know, many people are struggling. I know you are up against it, the digital landscape. We share your concerns. As you know, many people are struggling. We hope this note finds you and your family safe. We've never seen anything like this before. Here are 25 distance learning tips. As you know, many people are struggling. Feeling fiesta today? Happy Taco Tuesday! Calories don't count during a pandemic. Grocers report flour shortages as more people are baking than ever. As you know, many people are struggling. Count your blessings. Share your blessings. Get free curbside pickup or ship to your house. Chicken, lemon, artichokes. As you know, many people are struggling. How are you inspiring greatness today? We have a cure for your cabin fever. Pandemic dial-in town hall tonight. As you know, many people are struggling. Mother's Day looks a little different this year. You're invited to shop all jeans for 50% off. Yes, buy one, get one free. As you know, many people are struggling. Call us to discuss a loan extension without penalty. Act now. Tell Congress charters should not line their pockets during the COVID crisis. Now shipping face masks as recommended by the CDC. As you know, many people are struggling. This is not normal. That was the poem, The First Lines of Emails I've Received While Quarantining, by Jessica Salfia. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.